Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your very favorite every Monday podcast, libertarian, liberal, or otherwise. That's foreshadowing, people. All right, that's foreshadowing. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good morning, colleagues.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
We're going to reach very wearily into the rusty file cabinet marked masking commentary here in a moment. But first, data privacy is now finally in your hands. Introducing Secure, the instant messaging and email platform hosted in Switzerland. Trusted by privacy advocates across the globe, featuring 100% proprietary technology with zero affiliation with big tech behemoths like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, your data is now your own. Make the move to Secure by visiting secure.com. That is S-E-K-U-R.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. On Sunday, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, should always include the prevention there because people forget that, went on CNN's State of the Union program to warn that the U.S. is going in the wrong direction on COVID-19. Fauci further said that the idea of recommending that vaccinated people wear masks is, quote, under active consideration, unquote. Prezi Joe Biden suggested also last week that Washington may soon recommend that all kids under 12 wear masks in school, even though that is decidedly not the case in such backwater countries as, I don't know, Europe. This is all against the backdrop of the Delta variant going hog wild, increased COVID cases in all 50 states, increased hospitalizations in many places, and a slight, so far, uptick in deaths. Worth saying those ones out loud, we're now at roughly at a 7-day moving average of 250 deaths, which is up from 180 a couple of weeks ago, but down from 300 a month ago, down from 700 in April, and as high as 4,000 in January. Seeing masking remandates in places like LA County, and as 10% of public K through 12 will be fully back in school by next week, believe it or not, people. Public policy vis-a-vis the vaccinated and the unvaccinated is looming large in the discussion. So, Catherine, since you are the most philosophically inclined among us, what is government's duty to protect adults who choose not to get vaccinated? And how should that, if at all, affect rules governing how us vaxxers behave?
So I think the first thing to emphasize, which you just did a little bit, is that by every single measure, things are much, much, much better right now than they were a year ago or 6 months ago. Yes, there are breakthrough infections. Yes, there are variants, but the mortality and morbidity is just not where it was. And I think that in general, people are quite statistically illiterate. It's hard for the general public to understand how bad things are or how much better they are than they have been. And that really matters for the public policy response, including thinking about the appropriate role of government. So my view at this point is that a vaccine is available and it is not the government's role to stop people from doing self-destructive things. So that is the first principle. That is the basis of our thinking. I do self-destructive things that I would not like for the government to make illegal. We all do. I know you guys. You do more than I do. Self-destructive things that we do not want the government to make illegal. The question, of course, is now and has
That's
always been, how do you decide the line between what is...
You don't think it should be illegal to turn in your manuscripts a week or two late?
That's I will destruct you for that. So the question is now and has always been, how do you decide between what is self-destructive and what is other destructive? What is dangerous to other people? What is violence to other people, etc.? That line is blurry. People love to fight about that. So I understand why we are where we are. I think that there are still a lot of creative solutions left. There are like actually a lot more levers to pull before we get to mandatory vaccination or mandatory masking. And I would like to see us pull those. And we can talk about that more later. But I do think at some point people who don't get vaccinated are mostly harming themselves. Scientifically, it seems to be true that vaccinated people are still very, very protected, even from variants. And we may need to shift our thinking.
Where does that leave you? I'm sorry, Catherine, just to step on Matt's moderation, but
yeah. Shocker there.
Where does that leave you in terms of public schools?
Right. So this is actually a thing that we've talked about on this podcast before. I think that schools should be private. And so
But they're not.
I was going to keep talking. I was going to say like a second sentence in my answer, but if you don't want that, that's cool.
Start with the second sentence.
Maybe start with it. This is the Reason Roundtable, not the interview with Nick Gillespie. Go on, Catherine.
So I wish that schools were private. I think that rightly, in a well-ordered society, schools would be private. And so one way to think about this question is, if schools were private, what would happen at them? And that's at least a way to inform your thinking about public policy. And in this case, I would say, listen, schools were private. Many private schools we do know, mandating vaccination in order to partake in a voluntary activity seems to be perfectly reasonable to me. I think that employers should be allowed to mandate vaccination as a condition of employment. So I think that schools should be able to mandate vaccination as a condition of attendance. I do not think schooling should be mandatory. And I do not think there should be truancy laws. And I do not think there should be enforcement on people who choose alternate schooling. And I think that enables a mandatory vaccination requirement.
Peter, earlier, Catherine called Americans stupid. So I would like you
Stand
to respond to the following.
Thank you for clarifying that so Peter could understand.
Yes. I talked a little bit too fast, though, there. That's true. I want you to respond, Peter Suderman, to the first of all, why haven't we been calling you Sugarman this whole time? I just feel like that's an opportunity lost. But I'd like you to respond to the following thesis that's been.
I'm not that sweet.
That's been making the rounds, which is as follows. The best single thing that the federal government can do to persuade the vaccine hesitant is to provide them with the most possible high quality information addressing their skeptical questions. And that's basically it. No cajoling, no name calling, no vax that thing up, just high quality information done in a way that is persuasive just in its informationness. What are your thoughts on that as an approach?
Well, I certainly think that that would be good and that the federal government has failed to do that. And that's a good first step. I'm not sure it's the only step that they should be taking. Just to pick something else that I think is really important is the FDA should authorize the vaccines. So they have authorized them only on a temporary emergency basis. They have not, officially their position is the jury's still out on these vaccines, even while all of the public health apparatus is, I think, correctly telling everyone to get the vaccines. And so there is a real disconnect right now between the FDA's process, which is always bureaucratic and slow and meant at this point, I think it's pretty clear. This last year and a half has just demonstrated time and time again that the FDA preserves its process and they say they're doing it to preserve the legitimacy of the FDA's authority. But what they're actually doing is to preserve the process. It's process for its own sake. And so I think the FDA's process probably cost us some number of lives, possibly tens or even hundreds of thousands of lives last year because of how slow they were to get the vaccine out to people in the first place. And I think they are still probably making the vaccination push slower. Because what they're doing is, on the one hand, saying, well, you have to get this vaccine. And on the other hand, our process is set up to determine whether vaccines are safe. And we haven't made that determination yet. And we couldn't possibly for several more months. And it's just absolutely crazy. And so in some ways, that's just agreeing with this premise that you should provide accurate information, because what they're doing by having, on the one hand, a push to get people vaccinated, and on the other hand, a process that says these vaccines, we're not quite sure if they're safe yet, what they're doing is providing conflicting information to people. And they should not do that. And providing conflicting information to people is something that federal health authorities have been doing for the last year and a half, and has been a problem and continues to be one.
Nick, what do you say to the many people in moments like now when we're seeing resurgent concern over the variants People who say things like, hey, what's the big deal with putting on masks again, or, you know, fill in the blank, re-locking down or restriction again until we figure out what's going on with the Delta variant. Why shouldn't we err on the side of caution at a moment of uncertainty? Dr. Nick Gillespie.
Well, I mean, to go back to what Catherine was talking about, we know that the Delta variant and other things is not particularly dangerous to vaccinated people. Why should you be costing people who have gone through, at this point, the best known and, you know, really effective safety procedure? I got vaccinated. I had COVID. I got vaccinated. I'm not going to get the Delta variant. And if I do, it's going to be moderate and mild. Why should I have to wear a mask because a bunch of other people have chosen not to? And I like the idea. I mean, I was talking about this from the very beginning of, you know, having safety protocols out there that are, you know, well vetted and believable, and then allow businesses, allow individuals to kind of decide their own risk level, how they want to proceed. So if you want to wear a mask, go ahead. I don't feel like I should be held hostage by other people's recalcitrance. I do think there's the larger question, which is a genuinely fascinating public policy question, which is vaccination rates have kind of stalled out in a lot of, you know, in a lot of places and are declining, you know, in terms of who, you know, new numbers getting vaccinated. How do you reach those people? And I think this is also something where, as Peter was suggesting, you know, if the FDA is stuck in, you know, reverse in terms of like actually, you know, doing what it's supposed to be doing, there is a terrible like lack of curiosity and action on the public health community side to how do you reach people other than, you know, who don't want to get vaccinated, who are vaccine hesitant, other than calling them fucking idiots, you know, which seems to be the way that people in the press and the, you know, the heavy sigh people in public policy, because they're associating vaccine hesitancy with Trump, you know, or whatever. And so we're not doing the kind of outreach that just from a public health perspective, cost benefit analysis, like if it helps to have more people being vaccinated, we're not even having those kinds of discussions of like, okay, how do you get somebody who's on the fence? And that seems to me where the conversation should be going rather than mandates on stuff that is probably not going to help anybody very much, but is going to continue to infringe on the freedom and liberty of those of us who are already doing what we thought was best.
There was a really good interview in The Atlantic last week by Ed Yong with a public health expert who has been looking, I think, in some smart ways. Correct. With a person who has been looking at how to reach the unvaccinated. And what she said basically was that most, or at least many of the people who are not vaccinated are not hardcore ideological anti-vaxxers, and that they have many other reasons for not getting vaccinated, including in some cases, they're just a little bit worried about side effects and they can't take time off of work, things like that. And so there's just a bunch of other stuff. But what the point that was really interesting from this, and I'm just gonna read from Young's summary, is that we're used to thinking of anti-vaxxers as sowing distrust about vaccines. But what this person was arguing was that they've also successfully sown distrust about unvaccinated people, many of whom are now harder to reach because they've been demonized. And that is true to some extent, that we've that the sort of the culture of around the vaccine discourse has treated people who are not yet vaccinated in some cases, just sort of as troublemakers, as people who should be looked down upon, and it has been condescending to them. And I think that is look, if you're talking to, you know, somebody to an Alex Berenson type, maybe, right, sort of the hardcore ideologues, right, a different attitude might be valuable. But in general, trying to reach the vast majority of people who have yet to be vaccinated, don't be condescending. Don't be smug. Try to reach them where they're at. And like, don't worry, even if you think you are morally correct to be condescending and to be smug, like, don't worry about that. Worry about what the actual best approach to getting them vaccinated is. And in general, with people, the best thing to do if you want them to do something is not to be smug and condescending.
Sounds hard.
I really didn't like the way that you said that.
Yeah. Catherine, Nick,
there, you know, if I may, on the Roku channel and Hulu, you know, where this is where super targeted advertising goes to die, because obviously nobody is actually watching these programs. But the city of New York has ads where they're trying to get people, like they have regular people kind of talk about why they got vaccinated. And one of the funny things about them is because you immediately shut down whenever, you know, an ad from a public service ad in the middle of, like, you know, an episode of Frasier, the 8th season of Frasier on Hulu is coming on, right? Or on the Roku channel. But they had a guy who was from Queens. And he was just talking, whatever, I don't even know what he said, but he had a shirt on that was like pro magic mushrooms. And it's just like, it was, it's just great. Like
they're trying to shake every tree.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. But it's like they are shaking every tree and every branch to kind of find different voices who will connect with an audience of one. So, you know, sadly, I'm sure that ad probably cost like $1 million of taxpayer money. But other than that, it was kind of good fun.
Catherine, Nick, before he started peeking on his own mushrooms here, talked about the how we shouldn't bend policy to, you know, reshape, remold the behavior of those of us over the age of 12 who have taken the vaccine. I'm guessing that you might have some thoughts about what people should do who are 11 and who hang out with 11-year-olds about that.
I do. Have some thoughts about the tween set. I would love to be able to vaccinate my children. And I understand that children are at significantly lower risk than adults. I think that that should be reflected in our masking policies for schools at the same time. Every little bit helps. And golly gee willikers, it really seems like, given that all these 12-year-olds are just running around doing fine on the vaccine, we could maybe move it along before the school year starts so that my children don't have to wear masks more. Like, I put my kids on the bus to summer camp today. They're going to be at outdoor camp all day long in masks. And it's, that sucks, my man.
No, no.
It's very hot. They told us to send several masks because the children like sweat through them, which was sad. I also just want to talk about, like, I really think people are just being so unimaginative about, like, Nick's shrooms guy Hulu ad notwithstanding. The last time I think I saw a Hulu ad, I was getting exclusively ads about HPV. So now I'm really rethinking a bunch of my life choices. But
I think, you know, the 10th time you watch that ad, you get HPV. So it's like the ring. Don't just turn it off.
Yeah. But, you know, the idea that it's like, well, all we can do is like try to write the right PSA for vaccine hesitant people. And it's like, no, you know what? In a slightly different system, we could be innovating on the vaccine to reduce side effects. This is like, okay, if this is a pain point, wouldn't it be cool if there was some way to slightly alter the vaccine and then get it approved quickly in a different formulation that reduces? Oh, just kidding. That's completely impossible under our system, and it will be forever and ever. Amen. Like, we should be bribing people. We should be doing lotteries. We should be doing, like,
there are lotteries in some states.
I know.
The lotteries don't seem to be working very well. We should maybe talk about this thing that that has been floated, which is bribing, right? Which is actually paying people to get the vaccine. And I have seen libertarians, I think totally understandably, say, wait a minute, you want to use taxpayer money to subsidize this and to try and get
But I think the response to that is, like, we are already using just insane amounts of taxpayer money to try and convince people to take the vaccine. We're just not doing it in a direct transfer way. And I, like many libertarians before me, think that direct transfers of cash are almost always the most efficient way to do things if government must do things. And so maybe this is a case for that.
I also think that some of the other, what we call NPIs, non-pharmaceutical interventions, so that's masking, that's business closures or capacity restrictions, that sort of thing. I think people have, over the last year, even as they have experienced all of those NPIs, right, which is sort of that's the fancy jargon for lockdown, right, for all the stuff that has been associated with lockdowns. I think people have underestimated the cost of doing those things, even just kind of basic mask policies. Now, not choosing to wear a mask yourself, but requiring masking in a city is quite costly. It basically makes bars and in many cases restaurants impossible unless you create an exception. And if you're creating an exception, why are you really doing this? It makes a return to offices much less likely, not impossible, but quite difficult in many cases. And that in turn has a huge downstream economic effect on downtown areas. I mean, if you go walking around the bar districts in DC right now, they're basically doing okay. They're not quite as lively as they were. They're actually quite a bit less lively, but they're much more so than they were, say, last summer. There's obviously a lot of people who are coming out again. But if you walk around downtown, the business district where the offices are, it is just dead as disco all day long. There's absolutely nothing open. And all of the kind of the businesses that rely on people going into offices every day, they've either limited their hours, they're limiting their staff, or they're just not open at all. And so there's a huge economic impact from that. And offices are just not going to come back, if they come back at all. They're not going to come back in a world where people are expected to wear masks inside all day long. If those offices can, as many of them have discovered they can, if they can figure out ways to work at home instead.
Just as a kind of data point, as everyone is getting really excited talking about masks one way or the other, I've noticed in the last several days just a dramatic fall off in people wearing masks on the subway here in New York.
Yeah, it's over, baby.
I haven't worn one in a couple of months, and often usually was alone, and now, boy, yeah, it's a. So I wonder how much of the discussion. Nick, I'll form this as a question with a baseball joke at the end, which is that
the required format of Reason Podcast question.
I thought you were going to go with an Eric Stoltz joke at the end.
In L.A. this past weekend or on Friday or something like that, there was a protest among anti-masking dingbats outside of a breast cancer treatment facility protesting the mandatory masks at a breast cancer facility. This was greeted with Antifa dingbats, who then immediately, between the two sides, had the most unconvincing slap fight since the last time there was
Since outside the spa that may or may not have
God. Since had Aliens trans versus Predator Requiem.
Blah, blah, blah. Mm. Yeah.
I just wonder if the masking debate itself is just the very online people. We are the podcasting equivalent of stupid slap fighters arguing with, you know, people writing bad op-eds in the New York Times saying that they need to mask everything. Meanwhile, people are like done with it.
Aren't
they're
those
just
guest articles guest, now, Matt? Guest articles. I mean, come on.
That's right.
Yeah. You know. I think that's a fascinating kind of thing to kind of observe, that masking. I took a ferry from Battery Park, you know, from the bottom of Manhattan to Sandy Hook, New Jersey, one of the greatest beaches in all of Christendom. And you were supposed to wear masks, like they told you as you were getting on, you have to wear a mask if you're inside in the main cabin. And nobody was wearing a mask. I mean, even like people who had walkers. I don't know what the hell they were going to do at the beach, but people with walkers were not wearing masks, like old sick people. I think in a very real way, it is over for masking, you know, on a day-to-day basis. But, and Matt, I will finish this up with a Bill James point, you know, related to baseball. But then you have that question of public schools, right? And of public places that where attendance is mandatory and where the entire economy is geared around having to send your kid to school from like 9 to 3, except on Wednesdays, because the teachers need an afternoon off, you know, in order to like get their drunk on or something. And, you know, and summer's off, of course, and a month off, you know, between Christmas and Easter and all of this kind of crap. You know, what do you do there? And there are signs that, you know, the major teachers unions are pushing really, really hard to, you know, maintain this idea. We're not opening up, you know, until everything is safe, and nothing will ever be safe enough for teachers to return. So you have that question where there is a parallel universe where masking mandates are absolutely going to stop things from happening, whereas you have most of the people flouting mask ordinances as they exist. And this brings me to Bill James. Matt Welch, when he talks about Pete Rose and Ray Fosse colliding in the 1970 All-Star game, you know, the fact of the matter is it's illegal to block the plate.
as a catcher, but it was widely practiced. And that Bill James says, you know, you can't have a good society where people are openly flouting laws. It leads to all sorts of problems. And you can actually see that informing his later work on various kinds of social issues removed from baseball. But it is true. It's not good to have a society where people are openly flouting laws.
I want to note that my brain fully shut off for the last part of that answer, except for when Nick said the word Fosse, and my brain was like, Bob Fosse? And I woke up and saw jazz hands
started snapping
and, snapping, yep. And then went right back to sleep.
You know what? Bob Fosse would have tagged
this
Pete
is,
Rose
I briefly
and not
had
been
a,
touched by him.
A vision exactly. of a better world made is what I'm saying.
Just a
Catherine
wonderful
dancing look. Dot gif.
Yeah.
Catherine.
And by the way, if I may, just to
again,
stay on Bob Fosse, you know, it's like when I think of Bob Fosse, of course, I think of Roy Scheider. In the same way, when I think of Patton, I think of George C. Scott. And when I see pictures of Bob Fosse, I'm like, God, he looks terrible.
He doesn't
like
look
Jaws
at all.
Era, Roy Scheider, like or Sequest DSV era.
Yeah.
All that jazz. Come
all
on.
All that jazz.
Peter, if you're not waking up in the morning,
come on, Peter,
rubbing like really bad Aqua Velva on your hands, slapping your face after taking a bunch of pills, and then looking in the mirror and saying,
and seeing the angel of death played by Jessica Lange.
Then you're not alive.
Guys, I'm just going to go watch Blue Thunder again.
Yeah.
Not going to. Tropic Thunder again. Catherine, save us from all of this by responding to three different points, Darryl and you'll Dawkins. Just pull whatever it gets you. This morning, New York City, Catherine, announced that it'll require all municipal workers to be vaccinated by the time schools reopen in mid-September or face weekly testing. Question one, how does that sound to you? Question two, what do you say to people who want teachers to wear masks? And then question three, I forget, just rule of three.
What?
Go ahead.
Just happened. Like,
question three was, what was my third question?
Yeah.
Question two was teachers wearing masks. Yeah. And question one was Bob Fosse.
Yeah, that's how I recall it as well. Yeah, okay.
No, but about either public workers either wear masks or get vaccinated.
Either they
or
get vaccinated
tests,
or they do weekly tests.
Yeah. So I think that especially when an alternative is offered, I feel relatively comfortable with this. Also, even public employment is at will employment. And I know that we sometimes have different rules about people in the employed of the public system, for example, at universities. But I, again, think that the model for us is like if something that ought to be private was private, for instance, running many of the functions of a municipality, what would happen? And the answer is for people in public facing professions, vaccination is a great idea. And if I was an employer in one of those sectors, I would mandate vaccination for my employees. And I would make exceptions for people who have medical reasons to get exceptions. And I would allow an alternative like this testing setup. You may recall early on in this pandemic, we talked and thought and wrote a lot about how to make testing easy and cheap and reliable. That has fallen by the wayside somewhat because of the miraculously fast development and distribution of the vaccine, but it is still a perfectly legitimate tool for people who want to go about their business and can't or won't be vaccinated. So I think, you know, that piece of it, it's fine. I don't, you know, I think that will probably not be the locus of the culture war. The teacher masking stuff, I don't even know what to make of this because the teachers were first in line for the vaccine. They are with a population of people who are even lower risk than most of us. Children both pose and face very low risk. And at some point, I just assume literally everything having to do with teachers is now somehow a gambit by the teachers' unions to not go back to the classroom. And I am already mad before I finish thinking about it, which is a sign that this is a culture war issue and not an epidemiological or policymaking issue.
Does Reason have a vaccination policy, Catherine? And do we know any people working at Reason magazine who have chosen not to be vaccinated?
Like, first of all, I'm pretty sure like HIPAA prohibits me from talking about this, but also fuck HIPAA. Yeah. So there's that. Now, here in the DC office, we talked amongst ourselves about who was vaccinated and discovered that people in the DC office were vaccinated and therefore it was safe for us to come back to work unmasked. We agreed that if you brought somebody, an outsider, into the office, you should let people know, and that people who weren't comfortable being around outsiders could choose to stay home that day, because we also don't have a mandatory attendance policy, much like public schools should have.
Here in New York, it's just been all orgies all the time with strangers, so it's all fine.
Catherine, no, thank
you. Just to give you a mental image of things.
Wow, Matt.
So we're going to shift topics away from New York
we're
orgies.
We're always really talking about kinda, New York orgies. Kinda, the subtext is always kinda, New York orgies.
Jesus Christ, Matt.
Kind of want to linger.
Matt is going, he takes the ferry to Staten Island.
And Roy Schneider's
Staten
there.
Island orgies.
Those Showtime. Cardboard boxes aren't going to flatten themselves. All right, we're going to get to our email of the week here in a second. But first, do you want to get happier? Who doesn't? Are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, emotional sunburn? Okay, I made that last one up. You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. We're not talking self-help here. This is professional counseling. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Matt needs to when his iPhone doesn't do the, it tells you the fingerprints, then I don't know how to do it with the app, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month with other financial aid also available, even though BetterHelp.com is pretty darn affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/Roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technical setup. They'll get someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, get another one. Please visit betterhelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, send all your emailed queries for the podcast to roundtable@reason.com. The following comes from the swell gentleman known as John Coville. I don't know how to pronounce his damn name, who writes, "Hey, y'all, it's slowly eroding, but it's still common to refer to left progressives in America as, quote, liberals, unquote. In the last podcast, for ejemplo, Suderman referred to the Democratic legislative agenda as comprising a liberal wish list. Given the accelerated retreat from the principles of liberalism on the left, even to the point of disdaining the word itself sometimes, isn't it time for classical liberals and libertarians to take the title?" Nick, no preemptive sighing. You were talking about scoff sighing earlier. To take the title and certainly never grant the honorific to either extreme on the right or left. I know the pedantic idealism here is in tension with using pragmatic descriptions that most people will understand, but at some point the balance tips over. Thanks, John. I know a lot of you, even the non-sighings, have strong thoughts about this, but Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
Sure. So I have long been a skeptic of the reclaim liberal thesis. I am, you know, have been familiar with it since at least, I don't know, 1998. So like, this is a conversation that has been going on for a while. And, you know, it's always felt to me a little bit like a stop trying to make fetch happen thing. Like, we're not going to get it back. It means other stuff here. However, I will say that Stephanie Slade has convinced me that we should at least be using the word, if not as the label for the thing that we are, it should be a word that is in the conversations we are having. That there actually is a very specific thing, which is liberal values, which is liberalism in the kind of intellectual history sense, which is worth preserving, which is currently under threat, perhaps now more than ever. And that is a tradition we should be hearkening back to. That said, I like to use lefties for the people that I disagree with who are more progressive or otherwise in that zone from me. And righties, people on the other side, because it is diminutive and slightly dismissive, which is a vibe I'm always looking for when I want to describe people who are partisan and different than me. And I still like the word libertarian, so I'm going to use it for me.
Peter, I know you have thoughts. Tell them.
Oh, yeah. So I think I actually want to use this question as an opportunity to talk about the Mai Tai.
Oh, man.
Mother.
So, yep. Sorry. So there are two types of Mai Tai. There's the historical version, the Mai Tai that is the pinnacle of classic tiki drinks. It's the peak of the form, right? If you ask tiki people, like, what the ultimate tiki drink is, almost always they will say the Mai Tai. And the definitive version came from Trader Vic's in the 1940s. It involved a very old rum and then eventually a blend of two different rums. There was no nixiang involved, right? But it also has curacao, lime juice, and orgeat, and almond syrup. And that, more or less, is the true Mai Tai, the one that the hardcore tiki heads obsess over. And they also argue over it. And a lot of what they do is they argue over the form of the drink, but they also argue about what really counts as a Mai Tai, what real Mai Taiism is. They're the classicists. These are the people who care about the drink, what the drink really is, and sort of its historical properties. And to be clear, these are my people. But there's also another Mai Tai, and that's the one you can get at a zillion cheesy beach bars across the country, and it has almost nothing to do with the real Mai Tai. Often it is blue. It's just a random collection of rum and juice, maybe some sugar. And, you know, there might be people who say, well, look, they're kind of the same, you know, since they all contain rum and fruit juice, but they're not the same. These are very different things. This is the popular conception of the Mai Tai, and then the sort of more serious historical conception of the Mai Tai. And people who are concerned about liberalism are the classic Mai Tai people, or the word liberalism, and everybody else is, well, everyone else. And of course, all of this tends to bug the classic Mai Tai people and the people who are like, no, this is what liberalism really means. They want to preserve the integrity of the word. And I think, you know, you can argue over the word and struggle to maintain the correct definition for a Mai Tai or for what liberalism is. But I also think arguing over the word isn't that valuable. It's not that we shouldn't do it at all, but what really matters is the form of the thing. And if somehow or another we transmitted a good Mai Tai into the future of American politics, even if people didn't call it a Mai Tai, right? If it was still the actual great original drink, then that would be valuable. And that's sort of how I feel about liberalism, too, is what matters is actually the substance that's underneath, not the label we give it. And we should be much more focused on the form of the thing and the substance of it, what's in the drink, rather than what we call it.
Nick, did you start drinking by the end of that?
Yeah. I think I drank, I relapsed, went on a bender, and now I'm sober again.
Welcome back.
By the end of it. So it was pretty cool. All in, like, only, what was that, like 15, 20 minutes?
Very common story.
Yeah, you know, it reminded me of my favorite scene in It's a Wonderful Life when Jimmy Stewart and Clarence the Angel go into Martini's, and Clarence is trying to figure out what to ask, and he's like, oh, do I want a rum toddy or whatever? And Sheldon Leonard, who plays the namesake bar owner, says, look, Pixie, you know, this is a bar where we serve hard drinks for men who want to get drunk fast, and he throws them out. And that's what I think about not only what Peter was talking
totally
about,
fair.
but also this question. I think John Koval is a great American. He's one of my favorite people in the world. I have no idea who he is.
He's
really
a good Twitter dude.
You know, we're libertarian, and it's going to say, I circulated in response to this question on our listserv. In 1995, I wrote a piece for Reason about reclaiming liberal.
Also the last time it was correct
and,
to describe our,
you know,
communications
I was in favor
as a listserv, but yeah. That's okay.
Yeah, okay, whatever. You know, and
it's a listserv
a
or a Mai Tai?
Liberals are distinct from progressives. I think it's worth, you know, if we're interested in describing the American political spectrum accurately, there is a world of difference between, say, AOC and Ibram Kendi and somebody like John Chait at New York Magazine, who is a liberal, who rejects a lot of identity politics, you know, et cetera. He occupies a different position on the political spectrum, just as conservatives and libertarians who, you know, and conservatives have always been using us, you know, when it suits them, you know, when they need a little bit of heat or a little bit of fun or a little bit of something other than, you know, the nausea that they induce in most decent Americans, they'll glom onto libertarians. But conservatives and libertarians are very distinct. I think maintaining the libertarian designator, particularly in an adjectival, directional, or aspirational form, as opposed to mandating, you know, absolute dogmatic belief in 10 policy positions that you must agree with 110%. Otherwise, you, sir, are a true leftist and statist and the worst of all things in the world. I'm with libertarian. Keep it libertarian. It's free minds and free markets. Libertarian gets at that in a way that liberal, progressive, conservative, libertarian, conservatarian.
Well, as someone who wrote my fair share of those types of pieces and who, as Nick can tell you, held on to the description or a modified description of liberal. Jesus Christ. We're going to get you.
So sad.
We're going to get you a
so
muzzle.
So sad, Matt Welch.
We're going to
Matt would say I'm an economist style liberal.
Face when other people
the worst
are
part
talking.
Is a muzzle would not, yeah. It would yeah. only prevent the that's, talking, not the yeah. annoying
that's,
nonverbals.
That's so why I went for the sock. Yeah. We needed to get a no, smothering
actually,
effect.
I had my jaw wired shut in 1988 and I was still able to talk. It just sounded more like Charlton Heston than usual.
Noise canceling headphones.
For all of us.
For all of us.
Sold.
At any rate, I think part of the way of thinking about this is sort of a building on Stephanie Slade's and other people's observations that there is definitely a rise of openly illiberal, anti-liberal politics on the right and the left, naming the Enlightenment by name as a problem. Which is, you see this in the trad cons that Stephanie's always going against. There is also at the same time a liberal right, the David French right, the due process right. I would describe as liberal, just as Nick described Jonathan Chait. I might use a different example. Someone more like John McWhorter, I think, is more reliably on the liberal left. So liberalism is, I think, a broader category than libertarianism. And I think just speaking very, very personally, I'm just not interested in over worrying about branding what is necessarily is my or my tribe's politics, like selling it. Like, what's the best way to sell this dish soap? My brain doesn't work in that sense. And I have a instinctive allergy towards people. There's this whole trend in the early Bush era, Bush 2 era, where we had, what was it, the crunchy cons, Nick? Those Rod Dreher had the crunchy cons.
I thought you were like an unabashed war blogger, Matt Welch.
War blogger.
That's not ideological. That's
purely descriptive.
Topical.
Right? Purely descriptive. Yeah. Topical. It is.
When actually, you were an economist style liberal.
Thank you. I was actually described book as an economist style conservative liberal.
What book was that, Matt?
It's almost like maybe the word liberal isn't a great and used word.
It's right here. South Park Conservatives, The Revolt Against Liberal Media Bias by
Brian
C. Anderson.
Anderson.
Got it right there.
So, Matt, you and I actually have long disagreed in many ways about the sort of importance of and fun of and usefulness of being really persnickety with your labeling and titling. We disagree with this. We disagree about this as bosses. Like, I think people's titles at work matter, too. But I think we also maybe this could be a generational divide that is opening up wider. I think that, you know, Gen Z loves a hyper-specific label. Loves it. Like, every Gen Zer has their own sexuality, their own gender. Like, I think that we would do wrong to say, hey, you know what? The ideas matter. The words don't necessarily matter. Let's not fuss too much about the labeling when we seem to be trending toward ever more hyper-specific labels. And sometimes those can be useful, right?
I think also, Nick will remember this, I think it was at the 10th anniversary fire dinner, which was a spectacular event in New York. Nick and I were in that process of working out the subtitle of our book, The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. And we were with some unnamed older libertarian hands around the table. And the older you were, the more allergic you were to the word libertarian because you were aware of the branding problems. You've been trying, you know, they've been trying to sell this for a long time and they became exhausted because of negative associations with the word or just it sounded weird, like librarian or whatever. And it was Nick and me at that time said, dude, just own it. It's fine. Which kind of, you know, that's where I ended up going and allowing myself to be described as that because that's how it's used in America. Stop being precious. Yes, snowflake. But I think you might be onto something there, Catherine, in terms of people finding their hyper-specific. I just think that there's a level of preciousness, and Gen Z itself is precious. So, like, just, you know, relax.
So this is Gen X talking, right, Matt? Yeah, now Matt is Gen X, so he's, like, rejecting all labels because Gen X is, you know, somehow above and apart.
It doesn't even matter anyway, man.
Don't you understand that?
It's apathyism for labels, man.
That Mr. Brady died of AIDS, man, my entire world fell apart.
Yeah.
The Gen X complaints society is just the worst. I think all of us, Gen Z, millennials, and boomers, and the quiet generation, if they can, you know, get up, everybody just hates Gen X, Matt Welch. And you've given them more reasons to. Nothing can describe
you personally.
I'm just trying to think of
nothing
you're
so
special.
Is
there a sentence that Nick Gillespie has ever said that couldn't be prefaced by "everybody hates"? And I think the answer is no. Speaking of "everybody hates," let's see what everybody has been consuming. Let's go with a hater first. Nick, what have you been consuming?
Oh, so I have been consuming the works of Bette Davis, who was a mid-70s funk recording artist who had been married for a while to Miles Davis. And clearly, you know, in the same way that Yoko Ono doesn't get enough credit for really weirding up the Beatles and making them great before they broke up, and I think they broke up independent of her, Bette Davis was married to Miles Davis as he was moving into his most kind of late 60s, early 70s kind of psychedelic, funkadelic phase. Her three albums that were recorded and are in the notes here, one is named, Bette Davis. It's eponymous, I guess we would call that. Another one is called They Say I'm Different. And then also Nasty Gal. I mean, these are three albums from 73, 74, and 75 that are absolutely fantastic. And you will hear a world of music coming out of this. And she's, you know, she's known among people who are more into music than I am. But I only heard of her over the weekend after reading a story about Black contributions to psychedelia and the fantastic site lucidnews.com. But Bette Davis, you will hear Prince, you will hear Erykah Badu, you will hear, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. If the Red Hot Chili Peppers believed what they were doing, they would approximate Bette Davis. Just songs like They Say I'm Different, Anti-Love Song, He Was a Big Freak, Nasty Gal, If I'm in Luck, I Might Get Picked Up. It's phenomenal music. There was a documentary about her made in 2018, and she gained some, you know, more reverence and attention then. But she lives outside of Pittsburgh in relative seclusion. Her stuff is on Spotify. Check out Bette Davis if you like where the 60s were going, and like Sly and the Family Stone, and then into 70s funk disco, and then the eruption of kind of disco and funk into mainstream music in the 80s. Bette Davis is just not to be missed.
That sounds awesome. Peter, what have you been consuming?
Well, this was a big weekend for Xennial dudes. That's men, mostly, who were born between like 1977 and 1983, who spent the Reagan years playing with crappy plastic action figures. There was, at the box
dolls.
Office, there was Snake Eyes, G.I. Joe Origins. Yes, dolls with swords and guns, which were awesome when I was 7 years old. And Snake Eyes, G.I. Joe Origins, it's the third G.I. Joe film, and I don't know if it's the best. It's not that great. It's maybe a little more
bronze
interesting.
It's like a full octave up before you could even grapple with that
My
thing.
God, you were prepubescent for a second.
I think we know what 7-year-old Peter sounded
like. So 7-year-old me would have been more excited about this movie, but somewhat older me was kind of disappointed, even by the low standards I have for G.I. Joe films. I will say it's a little more interesting because it actually kind of embraces the martial arts melodrama, and there's no G.I. Joe-ness to the movie until about an hour in, when like Colonel Scarlet Witch or something shows up and kicks some butt. And no, it's not. It's that's the other franchise, I know, but who
cares
about
any of
these characters?
Is Cobra still involved in these things?
Yeah. So it turns out that the Klan, Snake Eyes has started to join, is aligned against Cobra, and which they're doing some terrorism stuff, and there's a magic stone, and it's just so goofy, especially when you get to the giant psychic mystical cave snakes. Anyway, I also started watching the new He-Man series, He-Man Revelation, on Netflix. It's produced by Kevin Smith. Yes, that Kevin Smith, the guy who made Clerks.
It really was a big weekend for Xennial Dudes.
Did you shave your pubic hair and go through some kind of psychological regression over the weekend, Peter?
Why do we have to have pubes in this podcast?
I'm just saying, I don't know. Like, we're talking about prepubescent Peter Suderman's, you know, taste palate.
I'm glad that when I talk about He-Man and you picture He-Man, that's where your mind goes, is to underneath.
I'm Team Skeletor. And Frank Langella is Skeletor.
We know,
Nick. Yeah, come on.
No one's ever been more Team Skeletor than you.
That's it. That's all I got.
Catherine.
y'all, it's a good thing. Actually, my recommendation will be
Strawberry Shortcake.
Getting through everyone else's recommendations here. I listened to a bunch of episodes of the Liquid Bread podcast. This is a podcast about beer. It is a podcast from a friend of mine named Maddie Smith. He does it with two other dudes who are named Larry and Rich, which is
Do you think they were excited about G.I. Joe and He-Man?
Yeah, I was going to say, they do it with Snake Eyes.
The men hosting this podcast absolutely are interested in Peter's recommendations. And this, like many podcasts, seems to have been through some rough times during the pandemic, but the last 4 weeks, there has been a new episode every week, and so I feel confident recommending it to y'all as something to partake of. Now, here's the thing. I started listening to this podcast, and while I was listening to it, I felt myself becoming a beer guy. Like, I could feel it happening in real time. I was like, I'm getting opinions about hops. It's happening right now. And then I turned it off for a minute. And I was like, is now the time in my life for me to become a beer guy? And then I thought, yeah. And I turned it back on. So I'm going to be a beer guy now. I already am a partaker of beers, but I learned even in my brief listening to this podcast that my fondness for like imperial stouts and porters is outdated, that the kids these days have long since moved on. I still think they taste good. And one thing that I like about this podcast is that it is very open-minded. They talk a little bit of smack about 1995 craft beer guys as holding back the whole fluorescence of beer variety that is now available with their snootiness. The most recent episode was about milkshake IPAs and smoothie sours, and I learned some stuff about that. And you know what? See, you guys are the 1995 beer guy snobs.
Hey, trust
I heard
me,
you're
I wasn't
snorkeling.
Holding anything back in 1995.
And I appreciate about this podcast that they are sort of looking for a broader audience of people to become beer guys, and I will accept their invitation and be listening to this pod some more. So I guess Reason podcast listeners, if you are already a beer guy and you have some thoughts for a gal who likes a nice stout that has espresso poured into it and also maybe was put into a barrel that previously had bourbon in it, but wants to branch out a little bit, hit me up.
Duck Rabbit Milk Stout. Catherine, is there a beer
that's delicious
that like sticks out from this that like you had to rush out and you like their description made you want to rush out and try?
I will say that the descriptions of the Walking Mountain Brewery's offerings, which is based in Bozeman, Montana, they had a guest brewer on, I guess, from that brewery whose name I can't now recall, but he really did a good job selling his wares, and I will be looking around in DC to see if I can find some of those in the future.
My recommendation is of someone who's probably one of the only five good Twitter accounts out there, accepting every single employee of Reason except for a couple of them. Iowa Hawk blog Twitter account. In general, this is not the recommendation, but this is your introduction to Dave Burge, which I don't even know if it's his real name. Doesn't matter. Really funny dude, lives in Austin now. We are friendly. He's just very funny on the internet. That's what he's been doing for a really long time. But on the weekends, he has this thing called Dave's Car ID Service. And it is wonderful, where people just basically send in old photographs, preferably of their family, you know, grandma posing next to this car in 1943. Can you identify what it is? Dave is a total gearhead. He used to write for, and maybe still does, for various car magazines. And he's a wonderful long form writer when he's not lazy and actually puts pen to paper. But he does this thing every weekend on Saturday and on Sunday. He'll do a long thread and just sort of delightfully identifying what the car is, but also kind of re-describing what's in the picture and using great old timey language. And even if you don't like it, maybe even especially if you're not yourself a gearhead. And I totally am not. I just like to look at nice things and read good writing. It's just a delight in a world full of non-delights. And the actual recommendation here is that he has a new Substack, inevitably, called Dave's Car ID Service that you can find at DCIDS, right? Dave's Car ID Service .substack.com. I'm sure if you just follow his Twitter account too at Iowahawk Blog, you can get there, where he does sort of longer form examinations and tutorials about how to identify stuff and just goes down rabbit holes of weird characters and overlaps between Hollywood and engineering design and a bunch of other stuff. But it's just nice. It's nice, and it's good writing and a good person, and I wish him all the best in of success there. And if you want to support people doing cool, good things and making the world a better place and titillating your eyeballs with fenders, Dave's Car ID Service is for you. That's all the fender titillation that we have time for here on the Nick, I do believe there's a lot of people emails. We got tons of emails about our discussion last week about the Biden administration putting pressure on Facebook about disinformation. And particularly, we're responding to a thing that Dave Smith, comic Dave Smith, had written about that. And from what I understand, you are going to actually be discussing that with Dave Smith sometime soon on the recent interview with Nick Gillespie.
Yes. Dave and I have agreed to talk, and we're just trying to set a date.
That is great, and that will obviously be an evergreen topic that we will continue hitting.
I interviewed him a couple of years ago as well. It's out there floating on YouTube, I believe.
Yeah, and he gave a opening set at 1,000 different Soho Forum things as well, which is our other podcast. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And that's it. I will not be seeing you or seeing your ear holes next Monday. Someone else will.
Neither will I, Matt Welch.
Oh, wow. We're going to let the... Also. Who's going to bring the boomer energy? Who's going to scoff? I don't know.
Oh, no. What if we have a podcast without the boomer energy?
Yeah.
How will we survive?
How about you want to mark, Matt, what do you think the audience size, what's the size of the decline without us on it?
I don't think in those kind of zero sum terms, Nick.
All right. I think the question is what the size of the increase is going to be, and it's going to be
all right. It's on.
Oh god, now they're just going to like select someone who has the biggest Twitter following. Hi Robbie.
Also the name of next week's podcast is definitely just like all the sex and drugs, please listen, thank you, bye.
That's true. Just what's like the Maggie McNeil piece from like 3 years ago that always is in the traffic leaderboards. I think it's Maggie.
How to hire an escort one.
Somehow that just keeps coming up. Okay, goodbye.
That's going to be my first question.
We got a serious situation down in the Bronx. Our friend needs to get a message to the short man in the hat. He needs to deliver this message before the construction site contracts are handed down. It's of vital importance that these matters be attended to, so we may have to bring in our friend from Yonkers.
What?
I say we may have